Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for attending the third of these workshops to explore the issues of human rights, human and labour rights in wine. For the sake of those who've not been at the first couple, I'll quickly outline why this is an area of focus for SWR, or as they say in all the best American TV dramas, last time on human rights in the wine industry. The key reason we're running these workshops is that this is a topic for which there's a growing urgency that the sector needs to address head on. The wine sector's got excellent practices on environmental aspects of sustainability, but the human side still needs greater focus. There have been studies in the last couple of years by Oxfam into the wine industry in Italy, and Finwatch looked at the industry in South Africa, and they've identified real challenges. And in the past couple of months, the press has reported on labour rights abuses in Bordeaux and Champagne. In both cases, the French public prosecutors investigating allegations of human trafficking. And this public scrutiny will only increase, as will regulatory pressure, for example, from the EU's supply chain due diligence legislation. This means that addressing these issues will become a matter of market access for all wine producers. There's also a financial consideration. According to Wine Search in September, the month after the situation in Champagne was made public, sales of champagne fell over 21%. That's 7 million fewer bottles sold. Now, that may not be a direct link, but I think it's unlikely there's not some link there between that news piece and sales. So our first workshop explored what we actually mean by the terms human and labour rights. What does this actually look like in the modern world? What does modern slavery, trafficking, living wage, what do these terms actually mean? The second workshop went one stage further and looked at how other sectors are addressing these issues. We heard from Nestlé and Diageo about the very tangible actions that they're taking in their businesses. And we also heard about the international guidance for institutions like the OECD and the UN, which are in place to support companies in addressing these issues. Today, we'll take a further step forward and look at what's already underway in the wine sector. The central rationale of these workshops has been to show that these aren't issues to be scared of, but they're issues that can be successfully addressed in the wine industry. And today we're going to hear some great examples of this. To that end, I'm delighted to welcome our very august panel. We have Linda Libroni, who's CEO of Wita from South Africa, Jason Glazer, who's CEO of La Isla Network, and Silvia Bianco, who's the Italy Programme Manager for Stronger Together. Now, I've asked the panel to make some opening remarks for 30, 35 minutes or so, and I think they've all got presentations to make. And then we'll open the floor to questions and discussion. You've heard enough from me. So without further ado, we now get over to the really important people. I'm going to hand over now to Jason Glazer of La Isla Network.
As we said last week on our procedural, we talked about this with Diageo. So a lot of this will be reviewed, but I think it's important to hear from the people that operationalize these programs to protect workers from heat stress. And hopefully we can have a robust discussion about what are the practicalities in adapting it to wine, which I think, frankly, if we can do it on a sugar cane mill to protect workers from heat stress, kidney failure, and the rest, and the accidents and injuries that are associated with those exposures, we can most definitely do it in the wine setting. It's a logistically much easier setting than a 78,000 hectare sugarcane farm in Nicaragua. My background, actually, I was a filmmaker and then through a series of misadventures became an epidemiologist from the London School. So if you have any scientific-y questions, I will do my best to answer them, but I also am quite happy to answer the operational and logistics of how something like this would get started. So if you want to understand like why our organization exists, it's really about protecting workers in a changing climate. We know that the stuff that we've kind of battle tested in Nicaragua and Mesoamerica on heat strain and preventions and protecting workers from those risks really provides us with a living laboratory. Now we have it functioning and from Mexico to Nicaragua. We're active in 12 countries now. And it's really an insight into what's coming for us, frankly, in Europe and South Africa and the US and wine growing regions. And we've obviously seen what's happening already in Italy and France over the last several summers. And I know South Africa's been contending with some of these related issues as well. So by working in these already extreme environments in the Middle East and Mesoamerica, we can really provide insights into how to future-proof the wine industry for worker health. Our organization, like if you also kind of what's our mission is really about leveraging academia and public research and development funding for measurable impact. I mean, I think a lot of academics unfortunately get trapped in the publish or perish kind of paradigm. And what we've done is really provided people with how to use those brilliant minds and operational systems that they've developed in academia and bring them into the real world and test them. And it's been really successful. What I kind of show this slide for two reasons. You know, we have all these programs that are running through major funders like the European Commission, the Belmont Forum on Climate Change. We have two cooperative agreements with the US government through the trade agreements, and also anti-trafficking front with the Department of State and Department of Labor. We're funded pretty heavily through Sweden as well, and historically through the German development banks. My point is, you know, it can be scary to stick your neck out and publicly take something on. You know, you can quietly get to work as one option, but the other thing is there is public funding. There are public-private partnerships, and we've done that again and again. And in fact, you know, one of the organizations that really helped us get going is helping to host these webinars, and that's Vin Monopolet. And without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. They really helped open up, if you want to think of it as a market, the sensibilization of these issues in the sugar and other industries. And since then, we have the excellent program that we've got running with Diageo now in six countries, their entire rum supply chain. Turner Construction in the U.S., working with Amazon and several other supply chains. And of course, the sugarcane mill that we work. We're also consultants with the Pan American Health Organization. You know, heat stress isn't just how hot it is. You know, the risk is what you're doing in that heat. And we learned about this, and we advanced the science in one of the toughest jobs on Earth. Sugarcane workers expend the same amount of caloric expenditure as Navy SEALs do on a three-day deployment in one day. So these guys are kind of the toughest of the tough. And so you learn a lot by working in that really tough environment. But it's really about the environmental heat and what people are doing in that heat. What that leads to, though, are greater health risks, including kidney failure. You could have emergency services needed and outright early mortality from heat stroke, as we saw in Bordeaux and Champagne this summer. The other thing that people really overlook, and we learned a lot about this, about looking at data in the Middle East during the Qatari World Cup, was that you have increased falls, cuts, people literally stumbling into traffic, because the disorientation that occurs before a heat stroke during what's called heat exhaustion leads to a lot more accidents and early mortality as well. It's not always the heat stroke or the later kidney damage that will affect a worker. And we know that heat really affects productivity and reduces it. It's really about where there's high heat, very heavy work. And as we're learning, when it's hot enough and people are not acclimatized, you don't have to be working that hard to be in danger. And then insufficient labor protections lead to those outcomes as well. One thing to think about, which is really different in Europe and arguably probably South Africa as well, is our sugarcane cutters that we work with are acclimatized. They go through a 2-week acclimatization period. What we're seeing when people hit early mortality and are killed by heat stroke in something like wine production, it's usually because they weren't acclimatized and there's a heat wave. So we have to develop some flexible and adaptive systems to address that. But by being prepared, you won't be caught off guard, and you can protect your workers and not run into what is, you know, frankly, in France, going to be a regulatory and probably civil litigation nightmare for some of those producers. I think that's definitely on the horizon. So it's really important to avoid that. The impact on society of heat stress should not be overlooked, and there's a huge decrease in productivity. You're talking about 180 million people by 2030, according to the International Labor Organization, being affected. Reduced potential labor hours. There's a social impact, obviously, because if people are taken out of the workforce because of illness, injury, or death, that will often in the most tenuous areas lead to child labor, but you're also taking people out of their prime earning years. And then there's a massive impact on health services, because heat strain frequently affects the kidney, and kidney treatment is unbelievably expensive. They say that if the US did not have kidney treatment through dialysis on Medicaid and Medicare, that we would probably not be running much of a national debt. That is how expensive it is. So countries like South Africa, that's like the last burden they need, even Italy. It's really important to think about that. The impacts on the individual, I feel like we've covered them pretty significantly. So why do we think we're seeing it now? I think there's a number of reasons. I think in Mesoamerica, it's certainly the industrialization of agriculture. These are no longer farmers. These are labor contractors. These are not people that own their land and are working their land. That's how it used to be many years ago. But you have a rise of monocultures, and you have contracted labor that are working 6 to 7 days a week, often in inadequate protections. This is a big one. And I know this is going to depend on the country, whether or not this is part of the problem. But in France, it certainly was part of the problem, this piece rate. And it's a perverse incentive. People will work harder. And if controls and protections aren't in place and mandated and part of the normal workday, you know, you need to earn for your family. You're there temporarily as a migrant worker frequently. your frontal cortex will override all of those signals your body is giving you to slow down. The other big thing is increased research and surveillance, and we've been a big part of that. These are communities and populations that, frankly, were not being measured in many countries, including the US, and then a warming climate. I just kind of hit on that. Like, a lot of these things just go unnoticed. These are like the most vulnerable workers. Usually they're migrant workers, internal migrant workers in countries, and they often slip through the cracks of even most developed national health systems. Loss of labor capacity has been discussed quite a lot with heat stress. It's really like a market-driven response would be to address it, because we lose so much productivity when we're overheated individually, and the impact on individual farms and industries and entire economies is really becoming of greater and greater concern in Europe. What's really relevant to us here is also the social burden of early mortality and injury. Is agricultural workers, including wine, would be 35 times more likely to die of heat or become sick from heat stress than others. It's just about exposure. You're out there in the sun, you're out there in the heat, and you're working, and frequently there are not logical systems in place to protect people. You know, that's all the bad news. What are we doing about it? We take an integrated approach. We build up through academia, where we assess what's going on. We work directly with the producers and the workers and map out where the gaps and address them. This really is where the public-private funding comes in, because this takes more work than one would think and takes a little bit more sometimes babysitting, frankly, depending on the producer, to help get them there. Some people are really quick on the uptake. Some organizations have a much harder time adapting. And this is really where like the public funding can come in, where you can really guide people through the process of improving. And then we do a lot of assistance and implementation to make sure the design that we lay out is actually carried out, because you can have a wonderful protocol, but it's kind of common sense. It's not always implemented unless you really have the buy-in and the structural and systematic change at the organization. One thing to keep in mind, especially for our US growers that might be attending, the current regulations and guidance are kind of useless. And it's really important that we do site-specific work for two reasons: to make sure workers are adequately protected and that they have systems that are actually achievable. And, you know, La Isla Network, we actually work with EU OSHA and US OSHA, and we are informing the new heat standard coming out. So if you get in there early in Europe and the US, you can inform the heat standard so that it's actually functional, it's viable and attainable, and not this burden that is going to lead to a regulatory mess. So the issue with the current guidelines is they're inadequately protective, and they're also too restrictive. So if you look at the environmental temperature, when they start kicking in, people wouldn't be working in much of the world in the summer at all, and even the harvest season. And then if you actually look at the core temperature, which is what we're worried about with the heat strain, it's much too hot, much too early, and the regulations don't kick in early. So what we do is we develop programs to basically bring that core temperature down and have the structural systems in place in which to do that and measure it. And that keeps people protected. It's actually much more important than hydration. Hydration is still important. You should still have potable water if you can afford them. Isotonic beverages similar to Gatorade are really important and protective as well. But what we found through the research is you can be completely hydrated and hyperthermic, meaning too hot, and die or be injured. So it's really about mandated scheduled breaks based on the environmental average temperatures and preparation for heat waves and the core body temperature, which we measure. So through that, you can design an effective intervention. These measurements are done through Kestrel devices, Polar Team Pro bands, where we measure the heart rate. We work with the US Army and have developed an algorithm to give a translation to core body temperature, so that we can design the interventions based on both the environmental temperature and the core body temperature of the worker. Mobile shade is something that's really important, so that when workers do get called for a break, they're not wasting their time getting to the break station. It seems very simple, but it's a really insightful, helpful part of the program. Obviously, potable water is really important. And then you need sanitation in the field, especially if you have female workers. If you're asking people to hydrate more than they're used to, perhaps, it's really important to have those protective systems in, as well as sanitation.
Apologies for that, everyone. But as you know, technology does sometimes pose challenges. So until we have Jason back again, we'll ask Sylvia to step in. Sylvia, over to you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sylvia Bianco, and I'm the program manager of the Stronger Together Italy wine program. And I'm here today to tell you a bit more about Stronger Together, our work in wine so far and how we have been supporting businesses in addressing the risks of unfair recruitment and labor exploitation in the wine sector. So who is stronger together? We are an organization whose vision is a world where all workers are recruited responsibly and have a fair work free from exploitation. We materialize our vision in working together to enable businesses to embed responsible recruitment and employment practices to mitigate labor exploitation in their operations and supply chains. What do? We offer capacity building guidance, practical resources and training. We develop and carry out collaborative supply chain programs, which are country and sector specific. And we also offer monitoring and evaluation tools, such as self-assessments, but also independent verifications. And lastly, we also offer bespoke consultancy, advisory, and training services. Where do we work? We work in the US, in Mexico, in Costa Rica, in the UK, in Spain, in Italy, and in South Africa. But our wine-specific collaborative programs are in Italy and South Africa. Our guidance is founded on 14 organizational standards to realize responsible recruitment and fair work free from exploitation. And these standards have been comprehensively mapped to relevant international standards on responsible recruitment and human rights. Our methodology consists in a strategic management system approach and effective supply chain due diligence. And our methodology is based on the UNGPs on business and human rights, but we will go more into the six steps a bit later. The Stronger Together programs are collaborative programs. We work in partnership with our sponsors, who are retailers and first-tier suppliers within the global supply chain. On this slide, you can see our sponsors in Italy and in South Africa at the moment. We hold regular meetings with the sponsors to discuss the direction of the programs in a collaborative way, and we share updates and insights from the ground. They support our engagement with their direct suppliers, such as importers and exporters, and we support them in going further down their supply chain, thanks to our expert strategic partners. And I will share more about the work with our strategic partner shortly when we go more into the Italy program. So, a summary of our work in the wine sector so far, before we dig more into the Italy wine program. In 2017, we launched the South Africa program in partnership with VITA, the Wine and Agricultural Ethical Trade Association, which is also on our panel today. The Italy program was formally launched in 2023 in partnership with the Qualitas, although we had some initial capacity building webinars in 2022. Both in South Africa and in Italy, we have created contextualized training, guidance, and tools for the wine industry. To date, in South Africa, about 180 businesses have participated in our workshops. And in Italy, in just about a year, about 120 businesses have participated in our workshops. All this work has also been informed by our strategic partners, but also by the engagement with trade unions, victim and migrant support NGOs, government, and other stakeholders, such as Fair Trade. In the US, we don't have a dedicated program, a dedicated wine program, but we have engaged with the Wine Industry Association in California as part of our wider US program. And we have inputted into their social sustainability guidance and delivered engagement sessions with wine producers. As mentioned, as Stronger Together, we run collaborative programs and we work in partnership with strategic collaborators. Our partners, Equalitas and VITA, have been critical in establishing our programs both in Italy and in South Africa. Their expert insights have informed the development of our resources and training, and they have provided credibility and reach to gain traction in the wine sector. And let's dig more now into the Italy wine program. In Italy, our strategic partner is Equalitas. The Equalitas project and the related standard encompass the three pillars of sustainability: environmental, economic, and ethical. And addresses the entire wine supply chain. The Equalitas Sustainable Wine Standard addresses issues and concerns in the wine in the wine sector that can no longer be ignored. And Equalitas has introduced a shared and objective process of independent certification. Equalitas has been key in supporting Stronger Together in Italy in reaching the lower tiers of the supply chain and engaging the most relevant actors. And let's see who these actors are. In Italy, a second level cooperative is a bottling facility with direct contact with the buyers. In our case, the Nordic alcohol monopolies, such as Vin Monopolet, Systembolaget, and Alco. The second level cooperatives are owned by tens of first level cooperatives. These facilities receive the grapes from the farmers and produce the bulk wine that is sold to the second level cooperatives. The first level cooperatives have no direct contact with the buyers, although they do produce the wine. The first level cooperatives are owned by hundreds of farmers each. These farmers have no formal relationship with the buyers, but they are the ones where the grapes used to make the wine bought by the buyers are grown. Our strategic partner Equalitas has been crucial in involving the directors of the first level cooperatives in our workshops on responsible recruitment and fair work. And another great advantage of this approach is the fact that it has helped the buyers to better map their supply chain. It is often said that labor exploitation in the wine sector isn't as widespread in the wider fruit and vegetable sector. This may be true, but cases in the wine sector do exist and keep emerging. Very recently in Gorizia, in the northeast region of Friuli Venezia Giulia, four people have been arrested for illegal intermediation of wine workers. Workers were picked up at dawn from rundown dormitories and taken to the field by a minivan. They worked about 10 hours a day and then drove back to the dormitories and locked in until the next day. They were granted one day of rest per week, the Sunday, but not always. As media reports grow, reports from international organizations on labor conditions in the wine industry are also growing. As you may know, Oxfam published a report on working conditions on the Italian wine sector last year. Although the study has been criticized for its methodology, it has helped to raise awareness about the need to take more action in the wine sector as well. And here I wanted to offer you a snapshot, an extract from our Italy workshop. It is particularly loved by our participants because it highlights very well the supply chain actors across the tiers. It shows the linkages across the supply chain, and it shows how further down we go in the supply chain, the higher the risks. But not only, there are also specific processes where employment risks are higher, even in the case of direct recruitment, for example, in bottling and storage. So although risks get higher, the more third-party actors come into the picture, it is also incorrect to assume that it's just in these cases that we are in a riskier situation. Also, we always stress that working with intermediaries is totally legally in Italy. What's important is to establish a strong collaboration based on mutual transparency and have a thorough due diligence process. The answer is not avoiding what's risky, but working collaboratively to improve together the way we make business in respect of human rights across the supply chain. So what we address in our workshops are the common challenges for wine businesses. Here are some challenges. So forced labor and labor exploitation may not be on the agenda of importers, local wineries, or farm owners. Businesses may not know enough about worker vulnerability to exploitation or about illegal or poor recruitment labor provision. There can be limited management systems to help identify and manage risks, and not many supply chains or recruiters are certified. There can be a lack of transparency of supply chains, labor recruitment practices, and subcontracting. And staff members may not feel that they have enough capacity or capability to identify and tackle labor exploitation. So, what businesses can do to tackle these challenges and manage labor exploitation risks? Started from the UNGPs on business and human rights, we have developed a six-step framework to embed responsible recruitment and fair work in business operations and supply chains. In our workshops, we help businesses apply this framework through the resources that we have created, which I will show you in a second. The six steps are: make a commitment to do it, assess the risk in your business and supply chain and take the action to address it, provide a solution where victims are identified, and monitor the progress made and communicate externally to demonstrate what and how you're doing it. When businesses join the Italy Wine Program journey, they basically go through three steps. They attend our workshops, which equip them with contextualized information about labor exploitation risks in the Italian wine sector. During the workshop and afterwards, they use our practical resources to identify gaps in their human rights due diligence and assess progress. And for Italy, as you can see here on the slide, we have created a toolkit and a checklist on responsible recruitment and fair work. And they also use our resources such as policy templates and worker posters and leaflets to further support implementation on effective human rights due diligence. Again, here I wanted to offer you a snapshot of the headings of our verification checklist on responsible recruitment and fair work. For example, under assess, the checklist helps businesses to score how they map their operations and the steps they take during the recruitment phase. Under act, for example, the steps cover how to strengthen workforce engagement and ensure effective grievance handling. And lastly, under response and remedy, businesses can assess their remediation processes and use our remediation plan and remediation report guidance to make improvements. And last snapshot from our workshops, to show how by starting from a real case study, we apply the steps of the checklist on responsible recruitment and fair work. This is the most popular case in our workshop, as it really makes the audience switch from a compliance perspective to an extra scrutiny perspective. If all the paperwork seems fine, where can unfair practices be hiding? In this case, the problem lies with competitive rates. So has your business made sure that fees and rates are adequate to cover the full labor cost? Enough with Italy. Just a quick reference to the resources that we also have available for the South African Wine Program. You can access our materials and resources like the toolkit, worker posters and leaflets, but also workshop introduction workshops, but also advanced training. And lastly, how can you get more involved with us? You can join our collaborative programs. You can engage with our workshops and free resources available on our website. And you can also contact us for in-house training and bespoke support.
Thanks for that. I mean, I think what's, I think, striking is looking at that slide you put up of perceived risk within the supply chain, and how, as you move further out from as it were, the office, it went from more greens to more oranges to more reds, that as you got towards, you know, vineyard practices, hiring workers in from outside, that's the sort of areas where there's a lot less confidence that these issues are being properly managed. And I think that, you know, probably reflects, those of you that remember the first workshop, probably reflects what Phil Bloomer said, that if you haven't found any human rights challenges in your supply chain, you've probably not looked hard enough. But also, I think the point you made about the need to work collaboratively, these aren't issues that can be addressed by an individual organization. They are societally based, systemically based, and that's the way we need to look at these things. But I think one other thing I think is particularly important is this move from compliance. It's not just about a box ticking exercise. It's about proactively managing these challenges and these issues, and actually looking at whether your own practices are getting in the way. You know, as you said, are rates enough to pay the full labor costs? We've now had this sort of lovely late night radio link. Sylvia was talking latterly about some of the stuff that they've been doing in South Africa. So I'm going to pass over now to South Africa. To Linda Liprani, who is the CEO of WITA in SA, and she will explain who she is, what that is, and the work that they have been doing in South Africa. So, Linda, over to you.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Yes, to just talk a little bit about WITA, we're a social scheme. We've been operating in the wine industry down in the Western Cape and the Northern Cape since 2002. We started off with about 50 seller producers, and we're now at about 1,400 sellers and producers. And that represents about 75% of our vineyards that have gone through audit. And it's been quite a journey. I think one of the key things is that we've seen quite a lot of shift happen over the last 20 years from the very first development of ethical codes of conduct. And I think we were probably one of the first organizations, local organizations, together with the UK retailers, to look at the development of a local code of conduct and a standard linked to an appropriate inspection system. And I think appropriate is a really good word, because we've just heard Sylvia talk about programs, and I think you have to be appropriate and you have to adapt. And so all these changes that we've seen over the years, where there's been the development of more measurement, more matrix, more reporting requirements, different kinds of inspection methodologies coming into being, various retailers on various levels now sharing all that information and asking far more questions that I believe audits don't necessarily give us any answers to. We've now shifted into an entire realm of new regulation and country-based legislation requiring the management, surveillance, vigilance, and transparency within supply chains. And the question is, you know, how do we as local wine industries respond to all of this? And I think adaptability and collaboration is one of the key things that we've experienced as we are going forward. So, of course, largely, I think globally, many retailers and many supply chains have, in fact, overly relied on auditing. And auditing has got quite a lot of criticism over the last while. Not always trustworthy, and not always trustworthy in the sense that you can always pick up hidden exploitation or even the softer issues that workers might not always be all that confident to raise in a day-long audit. And so it does beg the question, is auditing enough if you want to develop and you want to progress and you want to start address very real issues of change and transformation in your industry? And if we look particularly at what is guiding the market's commitment currently, then obviously human rights impact has had a huge influence on the way people are wanting to understand what is happening in the various industries. The protection of human rights, we've just heard the elimination of forced and bonded labor through programs such as Stronger Together, very important. Many of our markets also looking at freedom of association, or the lack thereof, or the inability of trade unions to be able to make a mark within particular industries, and our industry is not the only one. And then along with other areas, and Jasmine has spoken about environmental protection, anti-corruption also, to mention a few. And then we've also got the move from the Consumer Goods Forum to look at a human rights coalition, where again, freedom of association, living wage issues, and we've heard about piecework being a critical issue within the industry, and then again, forced labor becoming utmost in people's minds. South Africa is not new to criticism. South Africa is certainly not new to social media on issues. And we've had, over the past couple of years, many, many issues raised in various forms and in various reports. And I think the important thing, and I'd like to talk about, is that, you know, one of the reasons people have said, well, you know, you get so much criticism, and we to get so much criticism, why is that? And we've said, because we'd like to be seen as transparent. We tackle issues, we encourage our producers to be able to be open about issues, not to be defensive about them, and to try and find the root cause of these things, to work collaboratively and to work collectively to try and address a solution to some of these issues. And so the question is clearly, are audits enough? Certainly we understand that standards are evolving, And we'd like to think that we've gone beyond audit. We haven't entirely relied on audit, although audit plays a really important part of the offering that we have. What we have done over the last couple of years is we've looked at different risks in different areas of our industry. And we've certainly started to work very programmatically. We need to recognize that we are indeed a seasonally based industry, and so migrant work, contract work, and seasonal work, those workers are incredibly vulnerable. And so looking particularly at how we can assist and engage and empower those workers has become quite fundamental to the work that we do and is raised in many, many reports. We've also noted that because we have farm workers that indeed, through our historical legacy, have lived and worked on farm, evictions and social displacement is indeed a huge risk. And how do we deal with that? Domestic violence, violence against women, incredibly prominent. And again, a criticism against audits, because audits tend not to be too gender focused. And so we've had to look at how do we start to bring in particular protocols to look at the protection of women. Land displacement, and I think land is a particularly important issue. And within the South African context, we have quite a few emerging farms that have come up that have agreements in place with our state around land that they've been given, but without any further support on this. So land issues, incredibly important in terms of providing support to emerging farmers. Other issues around environment, obviously potable water, sanitation. Because we're the wine industry, alcohol harms has come up, and we, of course, do have a legacy of DOP system. So the impact of that legacy still persists throughout the years. Equality and discrimination, always an area of debate within the wine issue. Climate change has affected us all, and I think we need to understand a lot more about how that starts to impact communities. And then poverty and food security, all risk issues that our producers and our supply chain needs to take into account. So how do you start integrating all of this into the work that you do as a producer, as a brand, along with certification requirements? And I think the first thing that we've started to talk about is the importance of how you integrate human rights into group policies, but also into your strategic planning processes. And then very importantly, cascading that messaging, that support, the capacity for your supply chain to actually start to address it. So many of our brands are bringing their suppliers in and having these conversations about what does the changes in legislation mean, and what kind of support they can actually lend from seller right down to farm level. Disclosing how human rights considerations are integrated into your strategies, into your policies, into your procedures, not an easy thing, but we've done that through integrating that into our standard. And I think 2 years ago, we started to introduce human rights policies. We're now looking at the procedures and the mechanisms through which you actually start to give life to those policies. Reviewing complaints mechanisms, whistleblowing and speak up programs are equally important. And we're now starting to see, and I'll speak a little bit more about that, we're now starting to see many of the retailers actually approaching their importers, but their exporters, their South African exporters, and saying, well, what are you doing about this? What kinds of mechanisms do you in fact have in place to start to address this? And some of our more proactive brands now coming up with all kinds of ways, even hotlines that they are using. Heineken Beverages, for example, has a hotline that they actually use where anybody can phone in and lay a complaint, and that will further be investigated. I think the important thing is that businesses also need to be well equipped to deal with crisis. When that issue hits social media, when you get that report coming through, what are you as a brand doing about it? Not to ignore it and say, well, it's not in my backyard, it's not an issue I need to deal with, but how are you prepared to actually engage around the issue, fully understand the issue, and bring industry organizations along to support you in that process? And then what we found is unless these processes are not strategically led from the top, having your board of directors of your seller and your brand not only aware, but fully involved and fully equipped to address supply chain issues, you're literally, as a brand, not going to have very much impact in forcing down these issues all the way down your supply chain. So you do need to have leadership fully on board and actively involved. We've had CEOs that have sat down and written media responses to particular events that have come up in particular reports. That's how engaged we've had our leadership involved in human rights due diligence. And then the role you need to play, the resourcing and the expertise, it's become incredibly complex, but it's doable and it is practical in terms of who plays what role in addressing these challenges. So we've seen certain companies that have assigned compliance roles to compliance people, but on a strategic level, if there are issues that have come in, violations that have come in through the supply chain, then there's an expert team that actually take responsibility for that and drive those particular responses. So you're not left with a more junior compliance officer having to understand what they need to do in order to address any violations that come in. So as WETA, we've developed 6 tools to address human rights due diligence. The first is to have a really rigorous standard setting process so that every 3 years, you do get inputs both globally and locally on what the relevant issues are, and you can address these and make very, very practical guidance available to suppliers. We also undertake traceability, and I think traceability has become really important within the South African context to fully ensure that your product has gone through a rigorous set of audits certification. Risk identification, we do quite a bit of risk reporting in terms of identifying for particular suppliers and brands exactly what risk has occurred in their supply chains, where do the critical issues lie, are they regional, are they local, are they specific to particular suppliers, are those risks more bulk wine oriented, are they more premium wine oriented? So really starting to understand the analytics in terms of the information that you have is important to empower your brand to have the right kind of programmatic response. And then improving on that by mitigating the risks. We've worked very closely with many brands on particular areas where they have identified their particular risk. And that risk, as I said, may be related to alcohol harms. It may be related to contractor work, and we've brought in those programs specifically to deal with those particular risks, very important. Remediation is becoming very important, and I think there are various ways in which we have proposed that brands actually undertake remediation. I'll talk a little bit about that in the next slide. And then continuous monitoring and continuous communication. So not just through audits, but through second party inspections, through questionnaires, through having discussions with your suppliers. And that way, producers are in the know about what's actually happening within their supply chains. I think really importantly is that our industry is very involved and very committed to sustainability and human rights. And in fact, ethical certification is a key performance area of the wine industry. And I think without that support, it makes it incredibly difficult to actually roll out a program of ethical and human rights support throughout the industry. The other issue that's really important is supply chain management. Our supply chain directives are not just driven from externally and from global retailers, but local brands, local buyers are driving that change. And so whilst they are accountable, they're actually cascading that responsibility down. And they're at the point where many of the grape suppliers have to sign particular agreements where they have to be certified even before they actually deliver on their grape. If wine is bought, that wine needs to be traced before it is accepted and brought into particular tanks. So quite a lot of supply chain management happening at the moment, and quite a lot of commercial risk that is considered before wine is actually wine and grape is actually purchased. I think really importantly is collaboration and partnerships. There are many conversations that are held. There are many producer meetings, seller meetings, agricultural meetings where these things are spoken about. They are on the agendas constantly. And that means there's open discussion about what's coming up and what we can expect. Quite a lot of capacity building, quite a lot of training, quite a lot of awareness. We run road shows to talk about the changes that are coming, whether they're coming from Europe, whether they're coming from the UK, whether they're coming from particular regions like the Scandinavian monopolies, for example. And that also drives change throughout the supply chain. I did speak about social traceability. I think that's quite unique to South Africa at this point. We have environmental traceability and we introduced social traceability back in 2012. And we now have quite a few of our bigger brands that will undertake social traceability before they actually buy any form of wine. And that becomes important, not just to put a seal on a bottle to say the bottle has been traced, but to also just to give them the assurance that their supply chain is their supply chain is ethical. Human rights due diligence in terms of how it's rolled out does have challenges. And we think one of the biggest challenges that we've come across in the discussions that we have is that companies and producers don't necessarily always have the right kinds of dispute resolution mechanisms and the right kinds of competence to drive grievances and disputes. And so that's a particular area that we found we've had to focus on in order to build the capacity and build the competency to know what is the most appropriate mechanism to use. So traditional mechanisms, you know, such as putting a complaint in a complaints box or a grievance box certainly doesn't work when you've got collective grievances that needs to be addressed. And that's where grievance redress and remedy actually comes into effect. So gone are the days where you can just rely on the state or just rely on organizations in South Africa, like we have the CCMA that does quite a lot of mediation and conciliation for us. And if you have a dispute, you can simply say to your worker, you can simply say to the trade union, well, take it up with the CCMA and we'll meet you in court. I think the challenge is with human rights due diligence, you've got to find alternative dispute mechanisms through which you can deal with those collective grievances and those collective disputes and ensure that at the end of the day, you actually come out with a really proactive, restorative kind of solution that everybody can agree to. Interestingly enough, I think the old paradigm of auditing has always focused on corrective action. We believe corrective action can often be very short-sighted and very short-term. And so what we're supporting is far more longer-term sustained remedy. And what that often means when you have a violation in place is that producers are having to look at remedial action, which may involve compensation. It may involve apology. It may involve some way in which you've really got to think creatively about how do you reverse the impact and how do you prevent future harms. We've had instances in the past where we've had to deal with issues of discrimination by actually sending a producer for anger management, appointing a senior male psychologist to actually have to deal with a particular issue. So sometimes it means thinking quite outside the audit box and coming up with something that is far more long-term in terms of importantly restoring the relationship at within the workplace. I think also that when you're dealing with audit and certification, and particularly within the context of the South African wine industry, it's not just a focus on the workplace itself, but you've got to start to engage your community in that. So our audits and our discussions around any form of remedy very much is linked to community involvement and community engagement in order to strengthen that relationship. And it starts to embed the social responsibility of the producer and the seller way beyond the cellar floor, way beyond the vineyard, into that community. And often that's a really difficult thing to do. We have many producers that are doing amazing work in terms of social development, but are not very keen to talk about it because they don't necessarily want to get the kudos. And it's, so how do you try and bring the two together? Because it really is important to actually start showcasing what you are doing in community. Worker engagement is really important, and worker education on rights and responsibilities is just the start. I think we've shifted from passive beneficiary involvement in training to far more active, accountable initiatives where workers are really starting to get involved in joint capacity building programs on farm, where they're involved in developing action plans with producers, where they're involved in social dialogue programs, where we've introduced workers to trade unions. We have this MBISO sessions that we run in the various regions where workers may not have had the opportunity to actually have a discussion with various trade unions. We've also had mobile worker reporting, and the monopolies have gotten really involved in that with some of the major brands. Vin Monopolet has been involved in that. A couple of years ago, System Blogget was involved in that, all to enhance the workers' ability to give feedback beyond the audit. And at the moment, we're looking at a worker app with Legal Fundy and Vinimark, and we're actually hoping that we can introduce that and get traction on that particular area so that workers also have access to legal information and legal recourse, particularly workers that are working in very remote areas. So effective stakeholder monitoring systems is not just about doing an audit. It is about ensuring that you have good relationships with civil society and with trade unions, because ultimately they are your eyes and ears, and they are more likely to actually be reporting in any violations. In terms of those violations, we run a very active labor desk and a WhatsApp hotline that workers can have access to. But as I said, we're also seeing more of our brands that are doing a similar thing. So Heineken Beverages has got one in place at the moment. And we are promoting whistleblowing mechanisms because we do believe that communities and workers need to feel very confident and comfortable to actually raise these issues and have these issues addressed openly. I think what's also quite a nice case is with the Scandinavian monopolies is the agreement that they've signed with the IUF, the International Union Federation, where violations are also reported up to the Scandinavian monopolies. And we've had a case more recently where Alco has approached one of the bigger brands and said, there is a particular issue. Can you actually address this? And one of the bigger brands has had to go to a small bulk wine buyer that they occasionally buy wine from, and had to intervene and facilitate a process of engagement. And I think when you get to the point where you can get your whole executive team from a brand involved in lending support, encouraging discussion with trade unions and getting together around a table and saying, well, how do we actually solve this particular issue? That's a great start. Social dialogue, I think, really important. I'm not going to go through the slides, but we've had various initiatives in terms of social dialogue with various organizations, including Stronger Together. And I think that's a really important foundation upon which we've actually built our responses. And then lastly, to say just some of the lessons that we've learned. One is you really need to understand the salient risks in your particular supply chain. You need to integrate these risks into the way in which you address compliance issues. You really need to go beyond compliance. You need to have strategic executive-led supplier due diligence, very robust grievance procedures. Worker empowerment and worker agency is particularly important. You need to be vigilant on a constant basis, engage and invest in communities. Be open to engaging with opposition interest groups. That's really important. Swift remedial action and honest, and transparent reporting up the supply chain. If you don't know how to deal with it, be honest, say you don't. And there's lots of support. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks, Linda. And I think, as I said at the top of the conversation, I think what Linda's just outlined is there is good practice out there in the wine industry. And I think Linda's just given us a very good outline of some of that. I'm going to just ask Jason, who managed to get cut off by the sort of dubiousness of North Atlantic communications with Europe, to just say a few last words about how some of what he's learned applies to the wine sector.
Yeah, happy to do that.
So very quickly over to you, Jason.
Yeah, very quickly, I'm just going to plow through. So I just want to really build off what Wyeth is doing, which is really amazing. And I think what's interesting about what we've done is we have all local researchers and teams in Mesoamerica. And I love the fact that, frankly, South Africa is way ahead of Europe and the US on these issues. I mean, it might be tough to swallow, but it's true. And on heat stress mitigation, occupational safety and health, and the toughest industry, there's a lot to learn also in the global north. So I love seeing that script flip, frankly, and a lot of those biases overrun. I also just want to build off this idea, Linda, of like, this stuff can be intimidating. And the more that we can build apps and platforms, I think apps kind of cheapens what we're doing. We're building platforms that have apps for workers, for employers, and make these things easier. Like, not every wine farm needs an occupational safety and health chief, but you can build an app to make it a lot easier. And you're doing very similar things on grievance mechanisms and legal support. And we're doing similar things on remediation as well. I mean, this is a very focused talk for us, but we should put our heads together. I'm really impressed. And then this is also building off what Linda said, you got to have buy-in from the top on down. We have seen every permutation of disengagement from the top, from the middle, rarely actually from the workers. A lot of bias from employers will say, oh, the workers won't want to do this. I've seen it once, and it was frankly at an employer that has been so dishonest and so lacking in transparency with its workforce that they didn't trust us because we were working with them. But in any other setting, the workers are usually game to try something out that will protect them. And as you'll see, you know, lead to a return on investment for them and the workforce. So I'm going to show you return on investment data really quickly, because this all seems intimidating and maybe costly. It's not. You come out ahead. This is not data of a bunch of scientists cherry picking what we think is the economic data. This is the level of trust we have with the sugar mill is as such. We have all their HR data, all their financial data, and I mean all of it. So that when we review it, we're not reviewing what we want to see. We're reviewing the data on productivity, on expenses, on costs for all of their programs that they use to make their business decisions. So it's wonderfully unbiased in that sense. But what we've shown is a minimum of 22% ROI on providing these protections for the workforce. And those are from lack of turnover, training costs, equipment, salaries for medical staff because they have a clinic attached, production of their program, of their support that they also export. So they provide PPE to other mills. The productivity has gone way up, 10 to 20% on productivity in the two jobs that are most dependent, which is seed and burn cane cutting. So that's really what's remarkable. And so along with the ROI, you have a reduction in harm. If you look at the old system where site one is no workplace improvement and those guys are literally getting cooked to death over the day, and then you look at what we've developed, you said, oh my gosh, like how can that be that they're taking so many breaks and so many rests and they're only working 6 hours a day? Well, we've eliminated one of the biggest health concerns, which is acute kidney injury, which can lead to chronic disease and is related to heat stroke. It's a great proxy to understanding, are you having an impact? And I think this is the most impressive. We've reduced the workday from 8 active work hours to about 4.5 active work hours, about a 6 hour total day. And that blue line is the productivity through hour. And you can see where there are no workplace improvements, where the mill tried out their own stuff, and when we came in to really tune things up organizationally. And they have increased almost doubled some of their productivity per hour, not gone down. And their daily productivity has gone up 10 to 20%, not down with those changes. And it's hard to believe it would be any different in grapes. So expanding prioritizing, this is just kind of what I want to wrap up on. I think what's interesting organizationally is you need leaders that accept if there's a death on their farm, it's on them. It's not on the worker. The worker is going to pick as much as they can because that's how they get paid, unless you change the system. And what we saw in the response to France, frankly, was really troubling. I mean, if you have time to read these quotes, it was really about worker blaming and worker assassination. And I hate to sound so extreme, but I found it really, really upsetting. We are literally in meetings with the European Commission and EU OSHA when this happened. And I'll tell you, it's now been prioritized because this the timing all lined up. So we really have to change the attitudes and the organizational systems so that when something like this happens on a farm, to all of Linda's points, what I don't need to reiterate because you did such a beautiful job, Linda, like it's about owning it, addressing it, and moving forward and doing an inclusive and effective way. Do not shoot the messenger. Do not blame the victim. These are families that no longer have a primary earner. That's how it's got to be viewed. And I now work with sugar mills in the toughest industry, arguably, in the world in agriculture, where the CEOs are just like, if there's a death, if there's an illness, it's on us. And we now manage on those metrics. People are rewarded for not having illness. So that's just to kind of wrap it up. Where would I like to see us go? I know this is probably a few chess moves away, but we need like one center of excellence where we really focus on occupational safety and health. That's how we built it out in Central America. And now we're in all the Central American countries besides, ironically, Costa Rica and Panama. We have further up supply chain programs in Nepal, working in Guyana and Brazil and South America. And we're starting to work in the US as well, at least in the construction sector. So, and then, you know, to get going and collaborate with Stronger Together and WAITA in South Africa, we have our teams ready to roll in KwaZulu-Natal. They're already doing sugarcane work in Eswatini. So it's ready to roll. It's just really about building the buy-in and looking for those public-private partnerships so it's not a burden on the producer. But it's all utterly attainable, both in the EU, the US, and South Africa. So thank you. I hope that was a good wrap-up, and I'm just so impressed with my colleagues' work.
Great stuff, Jason. Thanks.
Oh, one thing I thought I wanted to mention is actually a colleague's idea at Biminoplet. Sasha had a great idea that we could do more focused occupational health seminars in Spanish and English when the time is right and the interest is there.
I think that's right.
I think that'd be great.
Well, that you've done a very nice segue into my sort of closing remarks, Jason. We've come to the end of these sort of initial workshops on human rights and wine, and obviously where we go next. Ideas on a postcard. And I think exactly workshops on specific topics, I think, might be a way to go. But in the meantime, on the behalf of SWR, I'd like to thank all of the speakers we've had in all of the three sessions, but also thank the Nordic Alcohol Monopolies who've supported these workshops. You know, as I think has become clear from what you've heard today, these are issues that will continue to rise in significance. You've got increased supply chain due diligence. There's also the reputation issue, but these are issues that historically many people in wine haven't been used to dealing with. But as we've heard today, there is some great practice out there. And we do need to make a shift away from a compliance approach to something that's much more proactive, to actually sort of, you know, as Linda said, you know, take ownership of the issues, commit, assess and act to take Zildjian's model. So as I say, we in SWR intend to do more work in this area. So as I say, any thoughts about how you think we can add most value, do let us know. I think further workshops will be one opportunity. We'll probably think about developing some good guidance, good practice guidance. And as just sort of highlighted at the last meeting, maybe even do some human rights impact assessments on a collaborative basis in some key growing regions. So at least we're all sort of singing from the same hymn sheet. But anyway, for the moment, thank you all for attending. And I hope you found these workshops valuable and interesting. And I'd like very much to thank our speakers today, Sylvia, Linda, and Jason. Thanks very much for some fascinating insights. Thank you and goodbye.